May it please the court, Peter Montine on behalf of appellants. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case is about a temporary restraining order that felt a little bit like a hit and run. Our clients, the appellants, the former employees, Derek Brown, Matt Schuler, and their new employer, Total Connection, received a temporary restraining order.
But we know the facts. Let me ask you a question, if you can answer it.
Yes, Your Honor.
The order that is on appeal was one that the trial court modified by interlineation.
Yes, Your Honor.
He says the motion was granted by a commissioner on the ex parte calendar. In granting the voluntary non-suit, defendants were not denied any substantial right under the circumstances. And I take it you take issue with that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any explanation of what the trial court was thinking about when he made that determination?
Well, Your Honor, because this was done without oral arguments, it's just speculation, but it seems that the court was tracking the language in McKay v. McKay, which is also about a voluntary non-suit, and discussed whether or not notice was required. And in that case, the court had said that the party had not been denied any substantial right because there wasn't any substantial right at issue. So I assume the trial court was just trying to track that language, but our case is different. There was a substantial right because the trial court had not yet addressed whether the enjoined parties had been wrongfully enjoined.
And therefore the bond was prematurely exonerated.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
So to continue, as you said, you know the facts. So the three orders that we are asking that this court, well, we're asking for really two alternative relief, forms of relief from this court, either to overturn or reverse the voluntary dismissal and overturn the release of bond, send this case back to the trial court and allow it to proceed to trial and for determination of whether the appellants were wrongfully enjoined, or if the court decides to uphold the voluntary dismissal, to award the appellants their attorney's fees as the prevailing parties to the voluntary
non-suit. Is there a third option that would be most favorable to you, and that is to reverse the order exonerating the bond and remand this with instructions for the court to consider whether your client's entitled to any recovery against the bond?
That is certainly one option. I think that fits under the first set of
To reverse the dismissal, the non-suit, to allow the court to consider that issue, do we?
Let me suggest an answer. You have an uphill battle to show that there is not an absolute right for a CR 41 dismissal.
Yes, Your Honor.
You want to answer now?
Sure. So, CR 41 starts off by saying that there's an absolute right, and then one of the exceptions is that there is a...
You're going down the wrong path.
Oh,
that's your Cox is trying to tell you,
sorry,
to tell me the dismissal stands, but that doesn't divest the trial court of authority to consider other issues, including your client's right to recover against the bond for being wrongfully enjoined. That would work out for you, wouldn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, we'd be okay with that relief. And then if I can address...
We don't have to overrule a lot of our cases and try and figure out how to dodge some Supreme Court cases that say there's an absolute right to a non-suit.
Yes, Your Honor. I think maybe the reason we would ask that this goes back to the trial court is to avoid the precedent that this case might set. The danger is that if we were able to go back and determine whether we had wrongfully enjoined, this still would allow a party to come in and get a wrongful or a temporary restraining order and avoid some of the protections that are put in place, specifically with regard to the notice for the voluntary non-suit.
Well, if you'd had notice, what would you have said that would have prevented the non-suit?
We would have explained to the court that we had a substantial right that was still at issue that needed to be resolved.
But the substantial right is to recover against the bond.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if we say that it's still there after the dismissal, what difference does it make?
I'm not sure it makes a difference, Your Honor.
And if there is one, tell us, because obviously we're giving you some hint of what we're thinking about.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess I'd say I'm not opposed to the hint of the relief that you were suggesting.
Wise choice.
Thank you. Then I guess I will wait for rebuttal to address any other questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Judge Mann, Judge Cox, presiding Judge Leach. Thank you very much. My name is Dubs Hirschlip. I'm appearing on behalf of Plaintiff Bulk Freight. And we're asking Your Honors to affirm the trial court's decision, both in dismissing this case and in denying relief against the bond. I'd also like to point out that there were sanctions awarded in favor of defendants at their request. They've had multiple motions.
Well, let's focus on the question of the bond. We're not interested in whether or not you have an absolute right to a CR 41 dismissal. I think the view of the panel is that you do. So let's focus on the bond.
Thank you, Your Honor. So it sounds like the complaint about the bond is that it was somehow there are two different issues, whether there's an abuse of discretion and whether there was a wrongful injunction. As to abuse of discretion, the trial court ruled. Defendants got to be heard about whether or not the bond was wrong, was procedurally inappropriately exonerated. They brought their motion. The judge heard it, released the bond.
Is that a question of law?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be a mixed question of law and fact. Wrongful injunctions depend upon facts not being disclosed, and I'm referring to the law of Farmers. I'm not seeing Farmers Insurance Exchange. I don't have the exact site in front of me, but Farmers Insurance Exchange addresses the issue of whether or not there was a wrongful injunction, and it's not whether or not there shouldn't have been an injunction or whether or not someone's been harmed by the injunction.
Did the trial court ever make that decision before it exonerated the bond?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the question, Your
Honor. Did the trial court ever decide whether there was a wrongful injunction, yes or no, before the bond was exonerated?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, the court commissioner exonerated the bond.
I'm talking about the trial court. So part of the problem that's possibly not in the record here is at the time of the exoneration, the trial court was in the middle of a...
I understand how ex parte works. You went to the ex parte department. The bond was exonerated by the commissioner.
No, Your Honor. First, we went to the trial court, and the trial court said, I'm in the middle of a murder trial. I don't have time for this.
So it didn't decide anything?
No, it previously decided that there was no wrongfulness in the nature of our request for a TRO.
What document reflects that decision?
Clerk's Papers 338.
And what does that say?
First, so 338 says that the appellants were not a prevailing party in the dismissal or the denial of the bond, which I would like to emphasize was only in place for 2 days. At the very core of this argument, there's no allegation of damages. So however far we go with this, there's no proof of damages. The total TRO was 2 days. And then in the language...
wrongfully issued. Would they be entitled to recover the attorney's fees that they incurred defeating the TRO at the time the court considered whether to issue a preliminary injunction?
Up until the time of the TRO hearing. That's correct, Your Honor. That's the standard attorney's fee.
So there is some damage for which we have some evidence since we know they had lawyers show up at the hearing.
Assuming, Your Honor, there's a little bit of a conflagration going on here where we have employer and employee being mixed. I believe that a competitor from out of state has funded this lawsuit. I don't believe that the two people...
That's all speculation right now. We don't know any of that.
No, in fact, Your Honor, only two people were restrained, two employees. This third party from New Jersey was...
Back to the question I started with a little while ago. What document would we look at to determine that the trial court decided there wasn't a wrongful issuance of the TRO?
The hearing on the TRO on Monday, December 21st, Your Honor.
And what in that order would tell us that the TRO was not wrongfully issued?
it is our argument that the judge found that there was sufficient evidence to move forward on a damages case, but that a restraining order was not appropriate because of the issues of enforceability.
Well, there wasn't any request to dismiss the complaint, was there?
No, there aren't. No,
the only issue at that point was whether or not your client was likely to prevail on the merits and would suffer irreparable harm if the TRO was not continued as a preliminary injunction, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So we don't have any decision at that point that there was either a wrongful or was not a wrongful issuance of the TRO.
I would disagree, Your Honor, but I'm not sure. I mean, I'm following your logic.
It seems to me all that the trial court decides at that hearing is you're not likely to prevail on this, so I'm not going to continue this, or you don't suffer irreparable harm. Money damages would be sufficient. Those are the two possible determinations the trial court would have made to deny the preliminary injunction.
Okay. If that's possible, Your Honor, then, or if that's the logic, then there should have been an
What's
appeal before
this. What's wrong with
that logic? I'm not finding fault with that logic, other than that when we went to the hearing, we argued the merits of our request for an injunction, and upon reconsideration, we also did so. It was opposed by opposing party. They had the opportunity to, in their opposition, make a request for a finding of wrongfulness or finding of damages.
Do they have to do it then, or can they wait till after they find out the result of the motion for reconsideration?
No, they have to do it at that time, Your Honor. That is the moment that the bond is within the possession of the court, and once it's gone, it's gone. And then to wait another 2 months to appeal that decision after the final dismissal of the case is an untimely appeal. They can't just go back and appeal the release of the bond at the time that the bond was, unless they do so at the time that the bond was released.
So if you're telling me that Clerk's Papers 338 is a ruling on the rightfulness or wrongfulness of the issuance of the TRO, that's what you're saying, right?
I'm stretching the language of the order. It does not specifically say anything about rightfulness or wrongfulness of the injunction. It specifically says the defendants were not denied a substantial right, which to me would also include a right to recovery for damages under any cause of action, including for wrongful restraint.
Okay, well, if we don't agree with that, then there's still a question pending as to whether or not the exoneration of the bond was premature, correct?
I don't understand the question. If there was a request for the exoneration of the bond, and
if the court had not ruled on whether or not the bond was wrongfully issued, or the TRO was wrongfully issued, then it would have been premature to exonerate the bond, correct?
No, I do not agree with that.
Okay, tell me why.
A court can exonerate a bond regardless of whether it was wrongful.
And what case do you rely on for that?
Any case or controversy before a court has to be presented by a party. The court can't just invent issues for itself. It has to have that issue presented to it by a party who claims that issue.
You're telling us that once you make a motion to exonerate the bond, the other party is obliged to actually assert its claim as opposed to saying, court, you haven't decided this question yet?
Correct, Your Honor. Thank you.
And what case do you rely on for that?
I think I would have to ask for permission to supplemental provide.
Well, it just sounds to me illogical.
Okay.
Because the whole purpose of the issuance of the bond is to basically provide an indemnity should the TRO have been wrongfully issued. I mean, that's my understanding of how the bond works.
That's correct, but we're talking about timeliness.
Well, yeah, we're talking about timeliness. It sounds like a race to the courthouse. If you get there to exonerate the bond before the determination has been made whether or not the TRO was wrongfully issued, then you win. That's essentially your position.
No. If you're given an opportunity to be heard, and during that opportunity to be heard, the defendants don't raise the issue of wrongfulness of the bond, and then they do so on appeal, I think that's an untimely appeal. That's an inappropriate appeal.
Let's back up a second. Was the order exonerating the bond entered ex parte?
It was eventually, yes, Your Honor.
By the court commissioner, right?
We brought it before ex parte, and then the trial judge, took the order themselves and ruled on it. So
because it was a motion to revise, how did the trial court get involved?
No, because I believe they were contacted by opposing counsel.
there was no opportunity for the defendants to be heard before the court commissioner signed the order exonerating the bond. Is that right?
That is not correct, Your Honor.
Okay. How did the defendants get an opportunity to appear in front of the court commissioner at the time that order to exonerate the bond was presented?
The order was signed by the trial court without oral argument. So the opportunity was in writing.
The order signed by the court commissioner. Wasn't there an order signed by a court commissioner?
The dismissal was signed by the court commissioner.
Okay. The order exonerating the bond was signed by whom?
The trial court.
And was there a hearing before that?
Not an evidentiary hearing, Your Honor.
Was there any hearing?
Well, without oral argument.
I mean, there was briefing from both sides?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. And we would just ask that you affirm the trial court below and provide attorney's fees for this appeal. Thank you.
I've got that right. You reserve 2 minutes.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honors. So I think in the questioning that you're asking opposing counsel, you were sort of getting at what the issue is here, is that we honestly didn't even know that this was an issue that was going to come up until it happened, the motion for release of bond, and we thought that it was a pretty reasonable explanation that the court had not yet reached the issue. We didn't realize that at that time that was our only instance to present all of our evidence for why the temporary restraining order had been wrongfully
Would it be fair to say the trial court was aware you intended to claim there was a wrongful issuance at the time it signed the order exonerating the bond?
I don't see how the trial court could think that we would not bring that issue before it, before there was some resolution of the case. And if I may, I'm sorry. The Washington law about temporary restraining orders specifically contemplates a judicial inquiry into the propriety of the issuance before action can arise against it. And the test is not whether the injunction was erroneous on its face, but when there's a later determination that the restraint was erroneous. And so the court never had that determination of whether or not the TRO was erroneous, and so it prematurely released the security, which was in place to protect these enjoined parties and any enjoined party from being subject to a wrongful injunction.
The injunction, I take it, was against not only the individual employees, but also the out-of-state entity?
Yes, Your Honor. So the language of the temporary restraining order specifically enjoined the two individual appellants, but then also enjoined anyone from assisting them in violating the temporary restraining order, which would necessarily include any employer who was employing them in this field.
The long-arm statute attorney fee provision apply to the attorney's fees incurred by the employees?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is a distinction between the fees incurred by one defendant or another. One of the defendants was out of state, and so the long-arm statute was invoked.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our calendar this morning.